It was Richard Weaver
who published a powerful little book, maybe at some level, a worldview book before people talked about worldview, called Ideas Have Consequences. The Bible begins with what I would argue may be the most potent idea there is. The Bible begins, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's how our story begins. Now, there's another competing story out there. Our story is that once there was God and nothing else, God was and everything else wasn't. But then God spoke all of reality into existence and it became the universe. Their story, well, once there was nothing and then there was everything. I think I have an idea of how this idea became popular and came to us. I have this image in my head of the devil in his war room, sitting behind a desk looking at all the markers on the map, and there's this knock on the door, and the devil says, "Who is it?" And here's these two voices, "Your infernal lowness. We've brought you a report from research and development." He says, "Come on in," and these two demons in white lab coats come in. And they said, "Well, we've been working long and hard. We know we've got this horrible problem where, you know, everybody can see, just as it talks about in Romans chapter 1, that there's a created order and that created order requires a creator, and no one's been able to get around that, but we think we've got a new way to do that. We call this Darwinism." Darwinism. Okay, tell me, what is Darwinism all about? He said, "Well, we're gonna go up there, and we're gonna sell this idea. We're gonna call Darwinism. We're gonna put a pretty girl on its hood. It's gonna do great." Darwinism. This is the story of Darwinism. Once there was nothing. And it and the devil said, "Wait, right there. Say that again." Okay. "Once there was nothing and it..." Wait a minute. "Once there was nothing and it." What is the it? It's nothing. Okay. I assume that... Okay, go ahead. "Once there was nothing and it exploded." Oh, wait. So nothing does something. Oh, yeah. And after it does it, then it's everything. Okay, you guys at research and development have come up with this great idea. There was nothing, and it exploded, and it was everything. Well, that's not all of it. Oh, well, tell me some more. Well, after there was everything, some of it worked really hard, and it came alive as an amoeba. All right, so we got nothing, we got everything, then some of the everything worked hard, even though it wasn't alive, and it came alive as an amoeba. Right. And then what happened? Well, the amoebas, they studied really hard too. And they eventually became fish. Uh-huh. Let me guess, the fish studied hard, yes? Ah, that's right, you're catching on. So the fish studied hard, and actually the fish didn't study hard. They kind of played hooky, and they went for a little walk. Left the water, and it changed and evolved, and now you have everything. The devil looks at these two researchers, and he says, "I'm pretty sure that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard." And the demons sort of crestfallen, and their little tails begin to sink, and they start to walk out the door, and the devil says, "Where do you think you're going?" "We're going to go back to the research and development. We're going to try to come up with something better." He said, "Why?" He said, "Well, you said it was the stupidest idea you ever heard. It is the stupidest idea I ever heard, but that doesn't mean we can't use it. Sit down, let's talk about this. The idea that nothing became everything is, of course, insane. But you know, it's an insane distraction. That's its function. You should understand this about evolution. It's not as though the principle or the purpose behind evolution was to unconvert believers. There are these people out there, they're Christians, they believe the Bible. Then comes Darwin, he gives this rousing speech. There's a pretty girl on the hood, and they say, oh, forget about Jesus. I like Darwin now. That's not going to happen. The reason that we have Darwinism is neither in order to help unbelievers not believe. These unbelievers, the devil doesn't need to make them stupid. They're already stupid. Right? The Bible says the fool says in his heart there is no God. And the devil has all of the soldiers on his side of this war, they're fools. So he doesn't need to make them foolish. He doesn't need to gouge out the eyes of the blind. He doesn't need to kill those who are already spiritually dead. So what's the point? It's not going to make Christians unbelievers. It's not going to make unbelievers more unbelieving. What's it for? Well, it's for a distraction. And it's for what it can do down the road. The reason that we embrace this foolishness is, again, because of Romans 1. Romans 1 tells us, they know that there's a God. We, when we were unbelievers, we knew that there was a God. We looked at the world, we reached the conclusion there had to be a maker. And we suppress that truth in unrighteousness. We hate that truth because that God that we know that we don't serve, we know that we stand guilty before Him, we know that we'll be judged by Him, and that's a very unpleasant thought. We don't like to think about it. So we turn on the television. Something. Got to get our mind off of this. And I've got to try to figure out, because I still have some remnant of the image of God in me, I've got to try and construct a world that makes some level of sense, but doesn't involve me having to answer to a God. Well, you can't get a world from nothing, so you've got to have a creator. But, well, this is a pretty crummy explanation, but this is a way to get a world without a creator. And from that comes so much more. You know, when we argue about economic issues, when you turn on your Fox News or you turn on your CNN or you flip back and forth, we're missing so much of the point. I'm sorry we're spending so much time in Genesis here, but it's important. One could argue, friends, that at the end of the day, the difference between Republicans and Democrats is this. One wants to consume half of our wealth and the other two-thirds. One wants socialized medicine, the other socialized medicines. In fact, mercy. Some of you got really excited about the Tea Party movement. And there's a lot being said in the Tea Party movement with which I agree, and which I'm happy about. But do you remember at the height of the language of the Tea Party, when they were in the news more than they have been since, you know what the key issue was? Tea Party people were active, they got engaged, they created their organizations because they were really mad about Obamacare. And you want to know why the Tea Party, or at least a large percentage of the Tea Party, was really upset about Obamacare? Because it took money away from Lyndon Baines Johnson care. Do you remember those arguments? We can't have socialized medicine. It'll destroy our socialized medicine. Right? You're going to take money out of Medicare and create this socialized medicine program? That's not right. It's the same thing. I remember 10 years before that. the Republican Revolution of 1994. Remember that? Boy, wasn't that exciting. I remember when the Speaker of the House stood on the steps of Congress as this great bold hero of liberty and promised us that he would make sure that nothing destroyed our Social Security program, because he's for limited government. The arguments between the two-thirds and the half, friends, are not the real arguments. Disagreeing about how much socialism we should have is agreeing that we should have socialism. We're going to be talking about the same principle tomorrow in the life issue as well. The more foundational issues have got to be examined. We've got to go back to the principles that are determining what's really supposed to happen. We haven't won the debate at the policy level, friends, because we've given up on the principle level. And to get back to the principle level, we have to go back to the beginning. Let's go back to this issue. Did God make the world, or did nothing make the world? Did God make the world, or did nothing make the world? I said this in the last hour. I want to say it again because I want you to get this. We will never change the world by insisting that my wealth is mine. But we will change the world if we actually believe that the earth is the Lord's and all those who dwell therein. As I said before, the affront of the 50% tax rate isn't that I've been robbed, but that the state pretends to be God, which means our problem ultimately is not economic, political, or even moral, it's theological. I've illustrated it this way. In the 1920s, we had a flu epidemic that killed tens of thousands of people. What did the country do in light of that? It was a mass appeal for prayer on the issue. Churches across the country, people pled with God for deliverance from this great epidemic. And as quickly as it started, it stopped. Jump ahead 65 years after that, you've got another plague that's killing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And the United States responded in the exact same way. They got on their knees and they prayed for deliverance from the scourge of AIDS. The only difference was they prayed to a different God. Now we're praying to Washington. Then we pray to the true and living God. The problem with statism is that it is idolatry and trying to overthrow the true and living God. Years ago, my father, speaking at an event with the late Francis Schaeffer, I mentioned this evening Richard Weaver, having written Ideas of Consequences before the rise of Francis Schaeffer, but whenever I find myself speaking in a situation like this or anywhere, the word worldview comes out of my mouth, I always stop and do this commercial. I always stop and say, you need to get something here. You need to understand that we would not be having this conversation if it were not for Francis Schaeffer. There would be no David Nobel if it weren't for Francis Schaeffer. There wouldn't be an audience for David Nobel if it weren't for Francis Schaeffer. That back before the days of Francis Schaeffer, you couldn't find 100 people who were asking worldview questions inside American churches. It's a revolution. And so there's my father, having shared a podium with him, now sharing a cab with him. And they shared a conversation. My father asked Schaeffer, "What do you most fear?" Schaeffer's reply was immediate and clear. He said, "Statism. Statism." Remember that statism isn't merely big government. It's not merely tyrannical government, but it is the religion of the state, the worship of the state. Now, creation, in affirming that God makes all things, necessarily likewise affirms that all things are His. Evolution, in affirming that nothing made all things, necessarily also affirms that no one owns all things. Creation is ownership. And if no one made it, then no one owns it. Which then creates a great deal of impetus. Let's look at it this way. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that I have followed some sound economics. You know, the first law of economics is God owns everything. The second law of economics is, if you want to prosper, you need to consume less than you produce. If you want to be poor, you need to consume more than you produce. Very simple. So let's suppose that I have consumed less than I produce. And I have established a surplus. And from this surplus, I have purchased some land. I have purchased this particular spot right here. This little square right here in the floor is now mine. Suppose also from my surplus I have purchased some tools. And I take these tools to my plot of land here. A little jackhammer, maybe a little pickaxe. And I get the carpet out. I get the subfloor out. I get down to the dirt. I start digging in the dirt. And I keep digging and I keep digging and I keep digging. And eventually, I find gold. And I sift the gold and I... What is this called? I'm panning with the right here in my square. And I'm panning and I'm getting more and more gold. And eventually, after all this work, I have a pirate's treasure chest full of gold. Whose gold is it? It's God's gold. And who has God given stewardship of the gold to? Me. Right? Anybody want to dispute that? Besides the president. It's not your gold. My land, my work, recognizing that God owns all things, my gold. Right? All right. That is how work and creation, work and ownership relate to each other. Now suppose that I haven't saved. And I haven't bought that piece of land. And I haven't dug it up. And I haven't gotten all that gold. Suppose instead that once, right there was nothing. And now there's a chest of gold right there. Whose gold is it? Whose gold is it? Huh. It just happened. There was no gold. And there it is. Just like the universe, right? Once there was nothing, then there's everything. Once there was no gold, now there's a big pile of gold. What are we going to do with it? Well, we could divvy it up equally, right? One way to do it. But of course, we're not individualists, right? God puts us in families. I'm in a family of 10. So I'm thinking we divide it equally in the sense that, you know, I represent 10 people. And, if your family's still half my size, you represent half that number of people, and so you'd get half of what I got. And if you're single, then you'd get a tenth of what I got. That's another way of doing it, right? But, you know, people are different sizes, too. Maybe we should divide it per person pound. Right? What do you say? Who's with me? Now, how are we going to decide which way to do this? Well, we could vote on it, right? But, you know, before we vote on it, I just want to invite all of you to come to my little donut party being sponsored by the pound per person party. And we would just love to have your support in the upcoming election. Here's some more donuts. And what do you, you know, now, if the party meets over here, the room begins to tilt, right? How are we going to decide? Here's what happens when you think that gold just appears. One, nobody does any work. Universes appear out of nothing. So why should anybody do any work? Then when there is wealth, the work that we do arguing over and politicizing the distribution of the wealth. So while we're arguing, should it be the per pound thing? Should it be the per family member thing? Should it be one just whoever's here? While we're having all these arguments, you know what we're not doing? Making more gold. Right? This is what evolution does. Think about it in terms of these horrible reports about how awful we are, these Americans. Do you know that Americans consume 25% of all the world's wealth, even though we represent only 5% of all the world's people? For shame. I love the Hazlitt quote that was up here about looking at all the equations. Because here's the simplest thing I can give you about understanding economics. Economists are magicians, not in the sense that they can do actual magic, but in the sense that they want you to believe something, and the way they get you to believe it is with misdirection and with hiding a part of the equation. Henry Hazlitt's book, Economics in One Lesson, I'll give you the one lesson. Save you from buying the book. How economical is that? It's a really good book. Get the book anyway. But here's the lesson. He asked the question. You break the guy's window, the store owner's window. Good for the economy, right? Because the store owner now has to hire the glazier to replace the window. And now the glazier's got work, right? And now that he's got work, he's thinking to himself, you know, my wife's always complaining about the way I dress. I'm going to go down and get me a suit. And he goes and takes the money he made from getting making the window. He goes down to the tailor and he buys himself a suit. And the tailor, having had a good day today, decides he's going to go and get himself a pair of shoes down at the cobbler's store. And he gets a pair of shoes. And the cobbler now is feeling much better off. And so everything goes wonderfully, right? Prosperity. Have you heard that kind of language? None of you heard that kind of language. You've heard it on the largest possible scale, right? World War II ended the Depression. It's really sad people have to die in war, but boy, it's good for the economy, right? If war was good for the economy, you know what we ought to do? We ought to take those war factories, you know, where they make tanks and fighter planes, and we ought to build them on the coast. And we'll bring in all the raw materials on one side of the factory, and we'll build all the tanks. And when they roll off the assembly line, we can just drive them right into the ocean, right? Because you know what war is? War is breaking stuff. That's what we do. So why not just break our own stuff? We don't have to travel all the way to, you know, the Middle East. We can just have our own little wars right here. Just drive our tanks into the ocean, and we'll all get rich. What's been hidden from the equation? Before the glass was broken, you know what the store owner had? He had the money to replace the glass and glass. When the glass was broken, he had the money to replace the glass. We have a net loss in the wealth of this community, not a net gain. So, but what I wanted to get is, what you're missing, what the magician is doing is he's saying, don't worry about that lost glass. Don't pay attention to the lost glass. Forget about the lost glass. Let's talk about the cobbler and the tailor and all this stuff. Same thing with tariffs, right? Times are hard. People are losing their jobs. What we really need to do is close our borders. Because when, well, I remember this, again, our great conservative hero, Ronald Reagan, signed legislation to save Harley-Davidson back in the 80s. Harley-Davidson at the time was the only American manufacturer of motorcycles, and they were being completely crushed by Kawasaki and Yamaha and Honda. And the president signed a bill that essentially, roughly, put a $1,000 surcharge on every Japanese motorcycle that could be sold in America that had to go to the government. So that Harley-Davidson, which didn't have to pay the $1,000, could suddenly become more competitive price-wise. Oh, and thank goodness, all those people in Wisconsin didn't lose their jobs. Right? That's the magician. Here's a factory. It's the Harley-Davidson factory. Here's all these people working. All these people's jobs were saved. What did you miss? You know what happens when you buy a motorcycle from a Japanese company? You know what they do? They send these ships over here with motorcycles and cars and televisions and all this. And you know what they, you know what we send back on those ships? Either worthless paper, in which case we've just had a really good deal, right? We've got actual stuff and they got paper. Or, more likely, you know what we send back over on those ships? Stuff that we make that the Japanese want. But it's not one company. So we've cut off the other side of the equation when the ship goes back, and now this company is selling a little bit less because the Japanese are not buying. That company is selling a little bit less because the Japanese aren't buying. That company is selling a little bit less. And now you're losing one job at a time from all these different companies. But you can't see that. That's why it's misdirection. To make it plain again, let's ask this question. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, I don't know, that American consumers know what they're doing. And they would rather have a dependable, inexpensive motorcycle versus a not dependable, expensive motorcycle. Right? And some economist comes up and says, no, you know, the way for us to get rich is let's pass laws so whenever anybody wants to buy a tool, they have to get the less good tool for more money. That'll make us all rich. That's what these tariffs do. We're much better off if our tools are homemade and bad and expensive. That's what a motorcycle is. It's a tool. That's what a car is. It's a tool. That's what a hammer is. It's a tool. Do you think we're going to get rich if we buy crummy hammers for more money? You gotta see the whole equation. And you've got to see how people argue. Again, America. Americans have consumed so much of the world's wealth. It's just so awful. Just so terrible. You know, you want to know why Americans consume so much of the world's wealth? That's right, because they produce so much of the world's wealth. No one ever asks the question. No one ever says, oh, those are not horrible. It's so sad. Those poor Americans. Here they are. They're only 5% of the world's population, and they're producing 25% of the stuff in the world. They're so overworked. It's so sad. You produce, you make, and it's yours. But when the left talks about this, it's just there. There's this pile of wealth, there's this pile of gold, and the Americans are taking more than their fair share. Ideas have consequences, friends. By the way, I'll say it this way. You know what else we could be importing that we don't, that conservatives don't want us to be able to legally import? Labor. This is why we want closed borders. Because we think, and Christians talk this way, if we can just prop up Joe's wages by not allowing Jose to come in here and underbid him for work, well, that's the loving Christian thing to do. But what have we done? Well, the magic is we've forgotten about Jose. Jose wants to come here and work. Now, I'm happy to affirm that there are plenty of Jose's that are wanting to come here and live off the government. That's a bad thing. A very bad thing. But you know what you do to solve that? Have the government stop writing checks to people. Okay? And then people who want to come here will be people who want to work. And then people work, and we get better off. I was having a conversation online about this the other day, and someone said, oh, if we open the borders, it'll overwhelm the economy. What does that even mean? Overwhelm the economy. All these people are working and producing. What do we do? Can't handle that. Brings us to trade in general. How do you decide who gets what? Well, you get what you produce. And you produce by serving your neighbor. But there's something else that happens that makes a wonderful, wonderful amounts of wealth. You know what it is? It's called trade. Trade is how we get wealthy. Think about this. Let's take my shoe. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that I've just shown my sock. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that I'm a cobbler, and I make lovely shoes just like these. And let's say that my costs for making these shoes are, it cost me $20 to make these shoes. And I go to Dick and say, what do you think about these shoes? I put a nice pretty lady on the shoe. I say, Dick, what do you think about these shoes? And Dick says, I think I'd love to have a pair of those shoes. I say, well, they're $40. And Dick says, all right, I'll do it. And he gives me $40, and I give him the shoes. It cost me $20 to make. Here's the question. Who profited on the deal? Yes, both. Why both? Well, I would like to get all the money in the world for these shoes. And I'd be willing to sell the shoes for $40. That's my range. $40 to infinity, right? Dick would like to get the shoes for zero. Because that's the kind of guy he is. He's willing to pay $50. Not a penny more. If I said, Dick, these shoes are $51, Dick would say, no, thank you. Right? But he's willing to pay $50. But I sold them to him for $40. Before we made the trade, he had $40. And I had shoes that I valued at $40. That's $80 worth of wealth. Right? I sold one. I said, I'm going to make it $30 because I'm not going to do it one for one. But you understand the point. I value him at $30 and he's got $40. So between us, we got $70. Now I give him the shoes. He gives me the money. He's got $50 worth of shoes and I got $40 worth of money. We now have $90 between us. All that happened is we traded. Now, why would he value the shoes for $50 and I would only value them for $30? I'm a cobbler, right? I got plenty of shoes. Who needs more shoes? I don't need more shoes. I only got 2 feet. All day long, I'm making shoes, making shoes, making shoes. Looking down at my feet, I don't need any more shoes. There's poor Dick walking around in the snow with no shoes. He values the shoes more than I do. This is called, in economics, the law of marginal utility. The law of marginal utility. This is, let me explain it to you very quickly. It's big words, right? You can go home and say you learned some big words tonight, but it's really not a complicated idea. Here's the way I like to illustrate it. When you're hungry and you go to McDonald's and you order that hamburger and you're really, really hungry and you eat the hamburger, you go in and you're so hungry, you'd be willing to pay $2 for that hamburger. And you pay $2, you get the hamburger, you eat the hamburger, and you're still, if you're me, you're still a little bit hungry. And they're getting ready to close down for the night, and McDonald's says, look, we got more burgers here. We'll give you another burger for $1.90. And I'd be like, no, thank you. I'm a little bit hungry. We'll give it to you for a dollar. Okay, I'll take another one for a dollar. So I eat the second hamburger. I say, look, we were hoping more people were going to come in. We still got all these burgers, and they're going to have to go in the trash. We'll give you three burgers for 50 cents. Right? At this point, I'm thinking, I don't even want to talk about hamburgers anymore. Right? So each increase in number is going to be valued less and less by me as we go along. And that's true for me as the shoemaker with my shoes. And whatever Dick has is he's going to trade for me. And that's a complicated thing we don't have time for. But he's going to value the shoes more. That's why we do what we do. Adam Smith came up with the law of comparative advantage. The law of comparative advantage, just two more big words. The law of comparative advantage is simply this, that people and nations should produce those goods and services for which they have the highest comparative advantage. All right? Mr. King, would you stand up, please? Big, strapping, strong man. Great hand-eye coordination. That's the guy that should be playing baseball, not me. Right? When God created me, I was not the scout's dream. No one ever says, run slow, can't hit the curve, can't hit the changeup because it blows by him. Can't move to his left, can't move to his right, and flinches when the ball comes straight at him. Sign this guy. That's me, right? Not me. I was not made to be a baseball player. I was made to be, well, some talk, right? That's what I do. So we do what we have. The same thing for nations, right? If I came to Montana today to ski, I didn't go to Jamaica to ski. Jamaica could look at Montana and all up and down the Rocky Mountains and say, golly, Neds, they're making money hand over fist. All these ski resorts, these people plunk down $50 to ski for a day. We need to get some of that action down here in Jamaica. And they build a nice ski resort there. How's that going to go? Not going to work. But when we all, this is the beauty of the body of the thing, see, is that when we each do what we're called to do, when we each fulfill what we're made to do, then we're in a position where we're able to trade with each other. And when we do so, we're able to bless each other and everybody profits. The great thing about freedom, the only way to prosper in freedom is to serve your neighbor. The only way to prosper under freedom is to serve your neighbor. The way you prosper under the evolutionary model is you become the strongest, the most powerful. You create the greatest voting block. You see the difference there? Under liberty, under creation, we get to be what we're made to be. When we're looking at the world as stuff just happens, we're just consumers. We're just fighting over the stuff that's there. People used to get this. I've heard it said that a barbarian was defined as someone who didn't know how to speak Latin. I think that's a bad definition. even though I can speak a little Latin. Historically, though, the difference between the barbarians and the civilized was simply this. Civilized people produce. What did the barbarians do? They moved from town to town, taking the stuff that other people produced. That's what they did. That's what Genghis Khan did. That's what the Ostrogoths did. That's what the Visigoths did. That's what the Vikings did. Smart enough not to go to Scotland, though. The people who produce, people who work, are people who can trade, which, by the way, is also why Adam Smith said, when goods and services cross borders, soldiers do not. The best thing you can do for peace is free trade. Friends, ideas have consequences. And until we get the fact that this is God's world, until we get the fact that work and ownership are tied together, then we're going to sit around bickering about whose idea is better about how stuff should be distributed. You know, one of the things that happens when people are able to keep the fruit of their labor, people who do bad things get to keep the fruit of their labor. It's awful. It's horrible. But people who do good things, they're able to keep the fruit of their labor. And people are able to freely trade. And people are made to be what they're made to be, friends. I was talking with someone during the break about Paul's admonition, if a man doesn't work, neither let him eat. Just like big government, the problem is it's bad theology. The problem with socialism is it's bad anthropology. It's bad for men's souls. Because this goes back to Genesis 1. This is what we were made for. This is not some idea. This is inherent in what it means to be human. That we work, that we make, that we create, that we enjoy the fruit of our hands. Look throughout the Psalms and the Proverbs. What is the pinnacle of blessedness in the Psalms and the Proverbs? That you eat the fruit of your labor. This is what it means to be a blessed man, to sit at your table with your wife like a fruitful vine and your children like olive plants, and you're eating the fruit of your labor. That's success. That's a picture of eternity. What socialism gives us, what evolutionary thinking gives us, stuff popping out of nowhere. That sounds great, doesn't it? Wouldn't it be great if stuff just popped out of nowhere? There it is. Walking along, well, there's a pile of gold. There's another pile. Look at that. Look. It'd be great, wouldn't it? But it's not great. It's not how we're made. And again, what we'll do is we'll spend all our days bickering over what's supposed to happen with it. You want to know who knows best what to do with what's theirs? God does. And when God gives what's His to someone else to steward, and you don't like the way they're doing it, take it up with God. God knows what He's doing. There's no gold under that square. But there is something better. You know, whether it's this square of carpet or any other square of carpet, whether it's this, whether it's that, do you know what all of this was once? This was all dirt. 5 years ago now, I took a trip, a week-long trip with Answers in Genesis down the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. And we rode these rafts, these giant rafts that had 18 people on them and everything we would need for the whole trip. Because when you go through the Grand Canyon and you're going to camp there overnight, you stop at a sandbar. And the sandbar could be here today, gone tomorrow. You don't know where the sandbars are. They don't stay put. They move. So you stop at a sandbar. You pull over. And one of the rules in the Grand Canyon is you can't leave anything behind. Which means when you pull into that sandbar, there is nothing man-made there. There is not a metal ring to tie your boat onto. There's nothing man-made. And that was quite an experience to sort of live like, okay, what if I had been Adam and Eve? And you're in this garden, and there's no accumulated stuff there. There's no man-made stuff. And it was difficult. Everything had to get off the boat and then on the boat. And very, very difficult. It made me think about the fact that Adam and Eve were there. And there was nothing. And now look at all this. All of this stuff in the room was dirt. Some of the dirt grew grass. And this thing that used to be dirt ate the grass. And someone killed the thing that ate the grass and made my shoes. Other things ate the grass, and they didn't kill it, but they sheared it. And they took the dirt that had been in the grass, it became the grass, it became the food for the sheep, and they made my suit. They dug holes in the ground. They made this amazing machine here. This is dirt that used to be liquid dirt, petroleum. That's what the plastic is. And really very fine dirt that you find at the beach because the insides are made out of sand. Did you know that? Your computers are made out of sand. Which ought to tell us something, by the way, about where wealth comes from. It all comes from dirt. Stuff you want to get rid of. Stuff that you know gets in the gears, but it's still what we make everything out of. This was dirt. It was all dirt, and men took it and worked it and melted it and sifted it and shaped it and molded it. And now we have carpets and suits and computers and microphones and lights and too much heat. And all of this because people worked, because people fulfilled the dominion mandate, because people were about the business of taking dirt and exercising dominion over it. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing reality. It's a glorious truth. We should all just stand in awe. What kind of a country? What kind of a country has scores of places where they've invested millions of dollars, billions of dollars, to carry people to the top of a mountain so that they can strap strips of fiberglass to their feet to go back down the mountain? Imagine telling that to Adam and Eve. You know this dirt? One day it's going to make this happen. And I was done. Got home, grabbed some dirt, twisted this dial, and hot water began streaming down on me, soothing my sore muscles. It's amazing. It's astonishing. We've got to stop taking this stuff for granted. Not because we're ashamed to have it, but so that we can give thanks. We live in a world of magic. Because God spoke reality into existence, made us His stewards, and we have been working at it ever since. Or stuff just happens. A whole different perspective, isn't it? Let's close in prayer. Our good and gracious Father, we thank You for Your magic. That You speak and reality happens. Father, we ask that You would give us the eyes of children, that we would rejoice and wonder at the glory of Your creation and the glory of your calling to us to be your stewards. Make us thankful, make us diligent, make us fruitful, and make us free. For the sake of your Son, for the glory of his kingdom, and the beauty of his reign. Amen.